Clerk, will you call the case?
Case number 28473, Stigman versus Outrigger Enterprises, Inc. Arguing for the petitioner, Janice Kim. Also appearing for the petitioner, Bruce Kim. Arguing for the respondent, Dennis O'Connor. Also appearing for the respondent, Michael McQuiggan. Argument on the merits.
Thank you. Good morning, counsel. My understanding, Ms. Kim, is you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is that right? Okay, and then you'll have a warning light come on at 5 minutes in your argument. And Mr. O'Connor, you'll be arguing for the respondent? Okay, and you'll get a warning light with 5 minutes to go in your 30-minute argument. Thank you very much. Ms. Kim, would you like to proceed?
Thank you. May it please the court. Thank you to the justices for allowing us to visit this issue today in the Stegman versus Outrigger case, and to look at the use of the open and obvious doctrine in the face of comparative negligence. Now, traditionally, a landowner was not subject to liability to business visitors for dangerous conditions on premises if the visitor knew and could recognize the condition and the risk. In Mikulski versus the Home Depot, the Second Circuit took pains to explain the historical underpinnings of this rule and noted that the no-duty rule in cases of open and obvious risk likely derived, as do many, from the special place ownership of land held in English and American law. Because the political power landowners enjoyed until the early 20th century, the availability of the open and obvious doctrine as a complete and total defense to premises liability began to be widely criticized about 50 years ago. This decision was written in 2000, so I think we can add 61 years ago. And a clear trend has now developed in other jurisdictions rejecting the traditional rule that has provided a full defense to landowners subject to premises liability. The theoretical underpinnings of the open and obvious law had really two distinct known and obvious defense bases at common law. The first was based on contributory negligence, and as we explained in our petition, the known and obvious danger defense is a vestige of the law of contributory negligence, which held that even the slightest degree of fault on the part of the plaintiff in failing to avoid or appreciate a hazard would defeat recovery.
Young versus Kim, excuse
yes,
me.
Your Honor.
Would Friedrich or Friedrich pose a problem for you?
Your Honor, Friedrich is the Hanalei case on the pier where Mr. Friedrich slipped off and fell into the water. And I don't believe that it does, although I know that it has been argued that it does, because if you read the facts in Friedrich and the court's own analysis, Friedrich started as a duty to warn case, and in the duty to warn, the failure to warn context, then the open and obvious distinction makes sense. I'm not here to exactly argue to you that there are cases that don't recognize that. But even in Friedrich, once the court, the
Didn't
Supreme
Friedrich
Court.
Didn't Friedrich say, though, that if there is evidence of an open and obvious condition, then no duty is owed by the landowner to people coming onto the property?
No duty is owed to warn.
I'm sorry?
No duty is owed to warn. But it does not follow that it negated completely the failure to maintain. And in fact, in Friedrich, the Supreme Court went further in its next look at that case, in its next review of that case, and analyzed the failure to maintain. So even in Friedrich, when the court spoke to the failure, to the question of known and obvious, it was speaking in the context of failure to warn.
Counsel, wasn't there an argument in Friedrich that there, or the court referred to there being evidence that there was no guardrail? So doesn't it appear that the case actually was talking about both a duty to warn and a duty to maintain the premises in safe condition? And if that's so, would we need to overrule Friedrich to reach the result you argue for?
No, Your Honor, you don't need to overrule Friedrich, because implicitly Friedrich went ahead and analyzed failure to warn and then analyzed failure to maintain. In other words, it didn't use the known and obvious defense as a complete bar to the failure to maintain. In fact, the court went further and looked at failure to maintain. And that's the area in which most courts have trended to at this time. It is not that known and obvious has been completely abandoned, but it has been limited to the failure to warn. It does not, however...
Are you saying, Ms. Kim, then, that the open and obvious doctrine should be maintained in some form?
It has been. In some jurisdictions,
should it be?
Well, it is maintained in many jurisdictions as only restricted to failure to warn, and here's why. Because it doesn't add anything for an invitee or a person on premises to warn them of something that is known and obvious. But then that alone doesn't abrogate the responsibility to remedy or take away or repair, maintain, construct, operate in a safe manner, discover, or make safe premises. If it did, the result would be poor. It would be poor because it would encourage people to create hazards that are huge and then not do anything about it. And that was exactly addressed in the two cases that we cited to the court, the Osborne case and the Slotsky case. And in the Osborne case, that was both situations have to do with cement for some reason. Slotsky has to do with tripping over a cement bag, and Osborne has to do with delivering cement to a company. But in either case, the courts there noted that actually what happened in our case is exactly what happened in the trial court in both those cases, where the court gave a sweeping known and obvious instruction that negated any liability on the part of the landowner. And the courts in both those cases noted that that instruction went too far, that the obvious nature of the danger is not in and of itself sufficient to establish that the owner of the premises on which the danger is located is not liable for injuries caused thereby, and that although the obviousness of the danger may negate any duty to warn, it doesn't negate the duty to remedy. And
Counsel,
I think that's what... Yes,
if
Ryan.
You could come back to Hawaii law, I know the ICA argued that there were other Hawaii cases which in its view had continued to recognize the open and obvious doctrine after we went to a system of contributory negligence. I think it cited the Harris case, which is an ICA case, the Cole case, K-O-L-E.
Right.
What's your reaction to that conclusion by the ICA? And again, do you think those cases are reconcilable with the rule you're arguing for today, or that we would have to overrule them in some sense?
No, Your Honor, Cole involved a golf ball landing in a condominium swimming pool. The golf ball came from an adjacent landowner's golf course. The condominium, the owner of the condominium, knew that golf balls were landing in their swimming pool. And the holding in Cole was that there was a failure to warn. So I'm not asking that Cole be overruled. I'm saying that Cole dealt exactly with what I'm talking about, which is the defense of failure to warn. And limited to that defense of failure to warn, many jurisdictions have, in fact, done the same thing because it makes sense. But it does not make sense to allow the known and obvious defense to then take away the duty to repair, the duty to remedy, the duty to maintain. And with regard to Harris.
So you want to sustain the open and obvious doctrine in terms of a failure to warn? You think it applies to a failure to warn?
I think that's the trend.
Is that the trend?
A trend in cases that we've cited. And also, Your Honor, I mean, I realize that if I could make the law myself, I would say that known and obvious defense should not apply in comparative negligence settings. But I realize that, in fact...
I thought that was your position in your briefs, that the open and obvious doctrine would be inconsistent with a comparative negligence statute.
It is, Your Honor. It is inconsistent with comparative negligence, where we also make claims not just on failure to warn, but failure to maintain, failure to construct, failure to remedy. That those, that the broad sweeping parameters that were given to this jury ended any discussion right after known and obvious. It should have ended discussion on perhaps failure to warn, but it should never have operated to completely be a full defense against us on all of the other claims that we had raised, because we are a comparative negligence state, because that made that contributory negligence. And we see that also happening in assumption of the risk. Justice, I want to get back to Harris, but
can I interrupt you just for a moment? When you're describing what you expect the jury is going to be considering potentially on remand, when you imagine the instruction, you're imagining instructions where the jury is asked to determine where comparative negligence would apply to the duty to maintain and where open and obvious would apply to the duty to warn?
You know, that was actually looked at, and I realize it's a mainland case, in the Osborne case, where the court noted that the error arose in the drafting of the instruction to the jury. When the qualifying statement that a business proprietor could not be liable for injury caused by failure to warn of an obvious or reasonably observable danger was somehow separated into two sentences so that non-liability for injury caused by an obvious or observable danger became an absolute statement of law rather than qualified to the duty to warn.
It does seem that it would be a challenge to put those instructions together.
Well, if the jury, in the Slotsky case, if the jury determined that the alleged unsafe condition was open and obvious and therefore there was no duty to warn, it should then proceed to consider plaintiff's other claims concerning unsafe condition. In the Slotsky case, the omission rendered the charge the part that it should then proceed to consider plaintiff's other claims. The omission of that instruction rendered the charge confusing and prejudicial, as it led the jury to impermissibly conclude that the defendant could not be found negligent if a condition was open and obvious.
Ms.
So,
Kim,
yes.
What's your rationale for urging us to hold that open and obvious is applicable in failure to maintain, but not in failure to warn?
No.
And would that be confusing to the jury as well?
My position is that open and obvious is available to the defense in failure to warn cases.
Yes. I'm sorry.
Right.
Did I get that mixed up? Okay. What's your rationale for saying it would be available
maintain.
In failure to warn and not
you know,
failure
I,
to maintain?
Thanks, Judge. I looked at the cases that had to deal with product liability. And in certain cases, in product liability, there's no need to warn someone that a knife is sharp or that a stove is hot, because that's obvious. Well, but it doesn't obviate the need of a manufacturer to from defective design. And so when I looked at those types of limitations on the failure to warn, open and known and obvious has some merit in the issue of failure to warn.
Generally, though, the case law between failure of product liability and premises liability has diverged, hasn't it?
Only until now. And it really can be used as an analogous situation, because the product liability cases absolutely consistently recognize that the failure to warn or warnings don't obviate the need to create a safe premises. If we go forward and we allow known and obvious to be a complete bar in any context, then there is no protection overall to anyone. I think it's the O'Donnell case that points out what it encourages a city and county to do is make a big hole and don't bother to cover it up or to repair it, because it's known and obvious. Whereas if they make a smaller hole, now they have a duty to remedy that situation. It turns things on its head. It doesn't make sense to create that kind of situation.
Ms. Kim, if I could interrupt you a minute and just ask about the facts of this case. I'm curious as to what the record shows as to what is the evidence regarding open and obvious, I guess, because to me, the fact that it rains on a lanai, I don't see that as a common sense being a dangerous condition. What does the record show?
The record showed that that lanai was sloped. The record showed that it was smooth, polished concrete. The record showed from Mr. Gill that that kind of a surface would be used in interior structures such as Costco or big box stores. The record showed that it was inappropriate for an exterior surface. The record showed that when water went onto that surface, it became as smooth as formica, and that it was it did not have a safe coefficient of friction. The record showed that another person, a worker, had been on that lanai and had been on a lanai in this structure and had slipped on the lanai. The record showed that Outrigger knew that smooth, polished concrete was a hazard because they had it in one of their garages and people actually slipped. The record showed that Outrigger had actually modified other hotels that it owned and put non-skid paint on the lanais to make them safer. And that was the record. The court gave this instruction over objection in a belief that water made concrete slippery. The issue wasn't the water. The fact is that concrete was the wrong coefficient of friction. It was an outside, outdoor lanai with smooth, polished concrete. And that was the record.
Is there any evidence that the plaintiff understood any of the representations that you just made about the record?
You know, the evidence was that my client stepped out onto that lanai, and in the first step, her foot slid violently out from under her and under the railing, causing significant, severe, disabling lifetime injuries. And
thank
that
you.
Was the record. Your Honor, I wanted to get back to your question on Harris because it is troubling. I can only tell the court that in looking at Harris, I turned to Justice Lim and his discussion of Harris in Gump v. Walmart and his limitation of Harris in Gump v. Walmart when he reminded Walmart that the Harris decision was based on findings of facts and conclusions of law, and that it really turned on explaining that Harris, as a case, involved no duty to maintain first the area around the water cooler, and then no evidence that the lights were burned out in the parking lot, and thus there was no evidence of an unreasonable risk of harm, so that the landowner had no responsibility to maintain the area, and the landowner is not an insurer against all accidents. That case is distinguishable, and as I reviewed it and went to Justice Lim for guidance on it, it appeared to me that it's not a case that looked at the open and obvious hazard question, and that's where I came down on it. With regard to...
Are you familiar with the Raposa case?
The Raposa case, no, I'm not.
It's a case where the ICA held that last clear chance conflicted with the comparative negligence statute.
Right.
Are you familiar with that?
I know that it conflicts with the comparative negligence statute. It is not used. I believe it's the same kind of analysis that was used for assumption of the risk, secondary implied assumption of the risk.
Yeah, now, part of that case indicated that last clear chance, because it barred total recovery,
right,
without taking into consideration the negligence of both sides, that in effect was inconsistent or clashed with the comparative negligence statute. So if open and obvious, that doctrine results also in total,
yes,
a total bar.
Right.
So does Raposa have any value in terms of the position you're taking?
The proposal has great value in the position that the contours of comparative negligence have modified those traditional arguments or doctrines. And I'm with the court on the position that comparative negligence should sweep away known and obvious dangers. But I looked also at other cases that have looked at this, and some have not. I will tell the court that it swept away assumption of the risk. I realize that the summary disposition order seems to indicate that Ferranda maintained assumption of the risk. That's not true. Ferranda maintained primary assumption of the risk when it came to sporting events, but Justice Lim again took pains to set out that secondary assumption of the risk came now under the hegemony of comparative negligence.
So, counsel, just so I'm sure I understand your argument, is that the contributory negligence statute abolished this particular doctrine, either explicitly through its language or implicitly if the language is ambiguous through legislative intent?
Correct.
Okay, and if that were the case, where in the statute would the distinction between a failure to warn case, which you, in which you say the doctrine would still exist, how would the statute maintain that at the same time eliminating it in the context of a duty to maintain? Is there something in the language of the statute or the legislative history that would support the that distinction?
Well, language of statute and legislative history would be nice. I am referring to not to those. In fact, the language and the statute itself should sweep away known and obvious. What I've studied is actually the case law in other jurisdictions that have used it in a modified form. When it came to comparative negligence with regard to duty to maintain and construct, remedy, repair in those contexts.
But how would you find it? Is that in the statute? In other words,
it's not. In other words, the statute is broad, and the justice is correct, and it would be absolutely reasonable for this court to find that that statute obviates known and obvious, and that known and obvious is absolutely a vestige of contributory negligence, just as assumption of the risk was, just as last clear chance was, and that it is not necessary to maintain it. That the instructions given on regular negligence then allows for a fair weighing of both parties' abilities and knowledge, and recognizes the heightened duty of this landowner of Outrigger to this plaintiff.
Thank you, counsel.
I notice in your application that you did not, although you raised other errors before the ICA, you didn't raise any errors in the application. So if the case is remanded, you waive your arguments on those other errors?
No, Your Honor, we do not. The fact is that the instruction that was given said Outrigger would be not liable. It was so sweeping that we were never able to go on to address anything else. It's not that we waived our arguments as to other errors. It's just that in the very limited ability to file a writ of certiorari on particular points of law, that clearly stood out as an error, as a grave error. And as far as the other contentions raised, we don't waive them.
Well, I'm just interested in one specific issue, and that's where the expert testifies from records, which clearly are hearsay,
right,
and thus presents before the jury derogatory information. Is that allowable under the rules?
No, and I can give you a blow-by-blow, moment-by-moment recap of that situation. Up until almost near the closing, the trial court was unsure and, in fact, had not sustained the plaintiff's objections to that kind of information coming in front of the jury, as a result of which testimony had been received in evidence in front of the jury that was not restricted. In the closing, prior to the closing, counsel had been instructed not to raise that argument in the closing counsel recited from a record that was existent before the court made its ruling not to refer to these things, but that was the record. To the extent that, as the summary disposition order points out, counsel failed to object at that moment, that didn't obviate the problem, which was that the defense was already aware of the court's specific instruction not to refer to this material. In the heat of the moment, an objection would have been helpful. I would ask the court to find that the known and obvious doctrine is a vestige of contributory negligence, that it does not negate other duties such as the duty to maintain, the duty to remedy, the duty to construct safe premises. If the court does not negate the known and obvious doctrine, then the court should at least limit it to a determination of the duty to warn, and that known and obvious can remain a factor in determining whether a plaintiff is comparatively negligent, but should never and is not a complete bar to recovery. Thank you,
Thank
Judge.
You, Ms. Kim.
Thank you, Justices.
Mr. O'Connor.
Morning, the court. First of all, I apologize for being 5 minutes late this morning. I blame the H1 freeway, but that it was raining. And I take it all back that I could have been faster, but I couldn't have been faster. I'd have been down in a different courthouse. Anyway, Your Honor, I obviously take issue with almost everything that Ms. Kim said this morning. The first thing I take issue with is her approach to the open and obvious rule, which is such an open and obvious rule that it's one that the court should just keep in existence. Because if you had everybody in this community, in this state, required to fix something that is open and obvious simply because it is, we don't have enough money in Hawaii to do all that. That would require filling in huge holes, filling in situations that are left that way because it's simply open and obvious that danger can occur, but people don't go around jumping into these situations and cause injury to themselves when they know that's going to happen. You can't just let this situation change when we've lived with it for so long, and we have. There's a misconception in the situation regarding where the present negligence law came from, how contributory negligence, which we have had in this jurisdiction for many, many years, has warped into what we call comparative negligence. It's not comparative negligence at all, because the first problem with comparative negligence is that there must be a finding that all the parties to the situation are negligent. And that usually doesn't exist at some of the crucial times when you're talking about comparative negligence. The situation where you have comparative negligence requires a finding by a jury, judge, or someone that the defendant and that the plaintiff are negligent. And if you give an instruction on comparative negligence without such a finding, then you are not comporting with what the basic principles of that situation really are. And that is that, by God, both sides are negligent. And you're measuring the negligence, in first of all, in deciding whether to give the instruction at all. Secondly, having measured that negligence, you are setting up a situation where at the trial level there shall be a determination of percentage of guilt or fault. And that's the kind of thing that, in this case, did happen. And the jury verdict came back, and you all will look at the jury verdict. The very first question is, was the defendant negligent? And the answer, clearly checked by the jury, is no. Now, I would suggest to the court that you have to do something with that before you skip on to the next issue as to how that plays into the various laws and rules that we're talking about. Because that finding by the jury is still there. I would suggest that you would have to set it aside for some good reason and or incorporate the fact that there might be negligence on the part of the plaintiff. That hasn't been done yet.
Mr. O'Connor, you raise a good issue or an interesting issue about the special verdict form. It really did not include any way for the jury to indicate that it had found that the known or obvious doctrine applied in a particular case. In other words, although the court instructed on the doctrine, the special verdict form didn't differentiate that issue in any way from the issue of negligence. And is that something that we should be concerned about?
Well, you have to be concerned about it if you are going to go where plaintiffs in the case want you to go. You have to do something with that finding. And I suggest strongly you just leave it be. It's a jury speaking after a long, tough trial where a lot of things happened in front of the jury. The jury saw the parties and was able to gauge credibility and a lot of other things. And here we come at this juncture and we say, well, you know, we're going to start a new trend here. Open and obvious is old, but we're going to go with this comparative negligence idea entirely. And with comparative negligence, we're not going to have a finding of...
Mr. O'Connor, excuse me.
Yes, Judge.
So would the finding by the jury have been the product, or can we ascertain that that might have been the result of the instruction given by the court that if there was an open and obvious problem, which apparently the judge thought there was, then the landowner or the hotel would not be liable. And so that this could be a reflection of the jury's following the judge's instruction that if there's an open and obvious problem, then the hotel is not liable.
I don't think from the jury standpoint, Your Honor, the judge made a finding that was open and obvious. The judge believed, I think, from what she said at various times, that it was open and obvious. But I don't think that was part of anything that went to the jury, the finding of open and obvious.
Well, the jury followed the instruction. Instruction told the jury, if you find that there's an open and obvious problem, then the hotel's not negligent. Sort of going back to the other idea you raised, we don't have a pure comparative negligence statute.
Yes.
So that there are safeguards in the statute itself. I mean, just, well, there's a 50% requirement.
Yes.
So that there's sort of a built-in, as I said, safeguard against someone recovering just because they may be 99% negligent, but still recover. So the legislature did build in a safeguard, that 50%, benchmark. But you also have a directed verdict, right? So if the court does find that there is no evidence of negligence, the court itself can enter judgment on behalf of the defendant.
Yes.
So we have these safeguards, and so doesn't that satisfy any problems that you see in terms of applying comparative negligence?
What the court says may be a safeguard, when you're in the heat of trial, is not a safeguard at all. When you move for a directed verdict and the judge says, well, I don't think so, there's this and that, you know, and a few other things, it doesn't work that way. It isn't crisp and clean as the court here would hope that it would be. It's all over the place. And so you take that and you work with it. And in this case, the plaintiff was negligent. But that negligence wasn't really hammered home because we didn't get there. We didn't get there because we were talking about weather conditions. We were talking about the condition of the lanai and the condition of the surface and the slipperiness that we're talking about and what the expert witness had said. Had the expert witnesses had said, because there were several different opinions as to what caused this incident to occur. Our position obviously was that it was the plaintiff that caused the situation to occur, and the plaintiff, by not grabbing a railing this is a real small balcony in an Outrigger hotel. We had pictures of the balcony. We had all sorts of things in evidence, which I'm sure are part of the file before the court. It would have been so easy for the plaintiff to herself stop her skidding or stop her rolling or whatever she did and not get injured. But she didn't.
Mr. O'Connor, by the judge submitting the open and obvious instruction, the jury doesn't even get to your argument regarding the plaintiff's negligence, right?
No, Your Honor.
Because it goes, once you say that the hotel operator is not liable to its guests for physical harm caused by them, for any danger that is known or obvious, and they come back with, after hearing that instruction, come back with no, it didn't consider the negligence of the plaintiff, right?
The first question was the plaintiff negligent? And they said no. The no was to the plaintiff's negligence. Was she negligent? And
wasn't it to the defendant's negligence?
I beg your pardon. Yeah. To the defendant's negligence. And the question was obviously set up so that they had to answer that before they went on to everything else that was involved in the case.
Mr. O'Connor, if I could interrupt you. I'm having a hard time understanding why rain on a commercial hotel lanai is an open and dangerous condition or open and obvious. Isn't a hotel guest entitled to believe that the lanai would be reasonably safe under the conditions? And rain is certainly foreseeable in Waikiki.
Yes, Your Honor. And our position in the trial and today here is that the lanai was safe, reasonably safe for the occupancy of the people who were staying in the room. You're talking about a space, well, it's in the record how big it is. It's not big enough to hurl a baseball 1 foot in.
But isn't it inconsistent to say that it's open and obvious and yet it's reasonably safe? It either is or it isn't.
No, Your Honor, you're missing the open and obvious. The open and obvious is the rain on the surface. That's what was open and obvious.
But isn't that foreseeable in Waikiki? And couldn't a hotel guest have the right to rely upon having a reasonably safe lanai? You know, that we either treated with epoxy or some other kind of covering?
If the court please, you're building something into the case that wasn't there. And that was any kind of a history. Well, I beg your pardon. There was history of no slippage on this particular lanai or in any lanai in that hotel. There was slippage on another lanai in another hotel of the Outrigger.
Also owned by the Outrigger, right?
Yes.
Right.
But in this hotel, no history of slippage. But getting back to your point, which I think is a good one, we argued like mad in the trial about the condition of that lanai. And the people that were involved in the trial itself did not accept the fact, we on our side for sure, that there was an open or an obvious danger initially until we had the evidence in which showed that it was wet. But it was wet that it was obvious. When it got wet, it was obviously wet because it rained on it, and the wet lanai was a dangerous situation. not just the lanai.
But counsel, then your view is whenever there's a surface that's wet and there's a slip and fall case, there should be an open and obvious instruction?
No.
Depends what about
on what
this
the
case?
Landowner has done to the surface in order to obviate a slip after it gets wet. But if a surface is going to be out in the rain regularly, then and you encourage people to get out on that surface, then yeah, something should be done to the surface.
But if you're not going to give the instruction in every case, what is it about this case that made giving the instruction appropriate? In other words, I'd ask you, is the rule that you're advocating every time there's a wet surface and a slip and fall, you should give the open and obvious instruction? You told me no. And my question is, when would you give it and when wouldn't you give it? And what is it about this case that made giving that instruction appropriate in light of the record?
The plaintiff's testimony that she knew that it was raining. She knew that it was raining on the surface, and she knew that the surface was wet. The surface being wet is what caused, according to the experts, the slip and the fall. We had a different take on it, but, you know, everybody has a different take on a situation that exists. But be that as it may, it's the wetness of the surface that is, and it's right there. You can see the rain. She steps out into the rain and into the onto the surface. The surface is wet from the rain. Open and obvious.
So whenever there's a plaintiff who's aware that there is a wet surface, the key is knowledge in your view. If the plaintiff is aware that there's a wet surface and slips and falls, there should be an open and obvious instruction.
Depending upon how the plaintiff characterizes it, I think the answer is yes.
And what do you mean by how the plaintiff characterizes
it? Well, if the plaintiff says, I didn't see anything, I didn't look, I wasn't asked to look, and she should have, that's one thing. If she shouldn't have, that's another thing. And, you know, that's the kind of distinction you draw from the testimony you get from people in this situation.
Mr. O'Connor, if we went the way that the plaintiff wants us to go, would we have to overrule the Friedrich case?
Yes. Not only that, you have to, in this case, you have to overturn that jury verdict, which we haven't even talked about yet, but the jury verdict was that she was negligent, and no more than that. So I'm not sure that the appellant
she was 100% negligent.
That's 100% negligent. And, you know, 100%, she was not 100%, she wasn't any percent negligent, according to the jury.
Well, the jury never had the opportunity to apportion or decide percentage.
No. Well, the answer is yes. They decided 100%, Judge. They ruled 100% that she was negligent. There weren't any equivocations in that.
In what sense do they rule 100% that she was negligent? By finding that the defendant was not negligent?
Yes. Now, if someone was at fault, the way the jury ruled, that someone had to be the plaintiff. Thank you. I have nothing else.
Thank you. Any other questions from the court? Justice Duffy?
I have one. Mr. O'Connor, you and I were both around at the time the comparative negligence statute was enacted in 1969. And I thought it was the intent of that to abolish all the common law defenses, which completely barred recovery under our former law. Wasn't that your understanding?
No.
Of the purpose of the comparative negligence statute?
Are you asking me as one who was there? The answer is no. As one who looks at it 10, 20 years later, maybe. But for sure, not all.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the court? If not, Ms. Kim, your rebuttal.
Justices, just to clarify the record, the incident report regarding the other slip on the surface of that hotel's lanai happened in the hotel. It is included as an exhibit to the trial record. It is the incident report of Outrigger. It is a situation where the housekeeper slipped on the lanai. The problem that I think we're seeing with the conceptual differences between Mr. O'Connor's viewpoint and what and the plaintiff's as to what is the unreasonable risk of harm here is not the water. It's the concrete being smoothed, polished concrete, the type of surface that should be in an interior structure and not in an exterior structure. And Justice Duffy is correct that Ms. Stegman, as an invitee, as a guest at Outrigger, had no ability to know that that concrete would be sloped and smooth and polished. And in fact, that created the unreasonable risk of harm. It was the concrete. It was the way in which Outrigger maintained that property that caused her to slip. It is not clear, even coming here today, that my simply walking through the rain on the concrete of the sidewalk should put me in some unreasonable risk of harm just because the sidewalk is wet. An exterior surface has to have a coefficient of friction that allows us to be safe. Concrete walkways all over the exterior of this town are safe. This one was unreasonable.
And I want to ask you a question I asked you before. Because I appreciate Mr. O'Connor's argument, because I think what he states is the law in the state. If you read Friedrich, and with their indulgence, Friedrich said, didn't only go to the duty to warn, as the Chief Justice indicated, because it said, the duty of care which the state as an occupier of the premises owed to appellant traditionally does not require the elimination of known or obvious hazards which appellant would reasonably be expected to avoid. So Friedrich placed it not in terms of a defense, but in terms right. of a duty. So if there's an open and dangerous condition, there is no duty
to warn
under Friedrich, not only to warn, but a duty of care. So my question to you is, if we go your way, do we have to overrule Friedrich?
If the finding of this court is that comparative negligence sweeps out known and obvious, then yes, Friedrich gets overruled. But Friedrich was looking at duty to warn, and then it went on to a second analysis on duty to maintain.
Well, it talks about what passage I read to you comes
right.
before the discussion on duty to warn.
Right.
But just the way they looked at the case going into the trial judges, as you point out, findings of fact indicating that the state did take reasonable care. I'm sorry, did take ordinary care to make the pier safe.
Right.
Indicates that they were considering not only the duty to warn, but the duty to maintain the premises in a safe condition.
Correct. Now, Your Honor, I would just remind the court, I'm sure the court is aware, that the question posed to the jury was not, it had to do with whether Outrigger was negligent. And the problems that were evident in the argument you just heard is that the jury never reached comparative negligence, because the known and obvious instruction they were given was a complete defense to all of Ms. Stegman's claims. I realize the court's going to consider it. I just need to make this pitch. This is a good case for the court to look at this and to make a determination that known and obvious does not any longer apply in our comparative negligence state. It has a tourist in a hotel. The hotel's duty is heightened because we are obviously a destination resort. It has a person who has a surface that is unreasonable in its risk of harm. It has a company that is so large that that clearly their engineers have to know what they're doing with their properties. And even if to my layperson's eye and to Ms. Stegman's, she would not have known about that lanai, they certainly did. They had control of that lanai. They had experience with those surfaces. They had remedied other properties. They had noticed that someone had already slipped. They failed in their duty to maintain those premises. And unfortunately, Ms. Stegman was denied the opportunity to have that heard. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kim. Thank you, counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement.